bringing order to the intersection of public, private, and civic. This is Infrastructure Momentum Makers.
Welcome to Infrastructure Momentum Makers, presented by Ansarada, the only software solution purpose-built to securely run complex and high-value infrastructure procurement. All your infrastructure procurement processes in one place, all in order. And join me, Ratna Amin, as I speak with the movers and shakers at the intersection of the public, private, and civic sectors about the latest breakthroughs and developments in the world of infrastructure. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by the principal and co-owner of Access Planning, Tamim Rad. Access is a strategic advisory and a transportation planning firm that helps city builders envision the possible, untangle complexity, and make decisions that shape our cities for the better. Tamim is here today to discuss how to manage regional politics and build great cities. Thanks so much for joining us, Tamim. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you again.
To start off, can you tell us about Access Planning, your firm, and what's your day-to-day role like?
Yeah, our firm, we're not a household name in planning. We're a firm of 12, 13 people, and we're in Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal. We do work across Canada and even across the Western US. We do infrastructure and policy advisory, strategic planning work. Most of our people have actually spent a lot of time in the public sector, and that's sort of our offer. It's a company owned by me and my partner, and came out of my experience spending about 16 years at TransLink, Greater Vancouver's transportation authority. I think one of the most successful regional transportation agencies in North America, and a lot of learning and building it from the ground up. And what I found in the consulting industry as an executive lead on strategic planning at TransLink and on a number of strategy files is that the consulting industry had become increasingly commodified and kind of built to deliver big projects, mostly the construction aspects of it. So designing, engineering, and delivering them. And a lot of the bigger questions around why and what, not just the how, weren't getting addressed and weren't really suitably addressed in the consulting industry. So I decided to start up a company, and that's Access Planning. We've been in business since 2015, and we provide a little bit of a niche of service in the consulting industry where we have a full life cycle view of infrastructure from plan to deliver, and we understand how to get it done just from our lived experience on a number of major projects, also building regional transportation strategies, doing really tough regional and city policy. Just having been through it, understanding what the decision process is, kind of bringing a little bit of that insight into decision facilitation at the front end of strategies and big projects. And what's our life like on a day-to-day basis? We work very, very closely with clients, usually at the senior management and executive level, to tackle these big projects, whether there's a big policy project or a big infrastructure project, and help them to navigate it through the planning and decision-making process internally, either within their organizations or in that interface with the political process.
So you provide a number of different services to your clients. Can you share an example of a success story, a favorite project that comes to mind? How and why did this project make such a great impression?
One of the ones that we worked on recently was actually helping Metrolinx, the transportation authority in the metropolitan Toronto area, help them through a project delivery challenge on a major subway infrastructure delivery project. So this is a $5 to $7 billion project, an extension of the mainline subway in Toronto into Scarborough, a suburb, with several stations along the way. I had been involved in this project in the very, very early days, helping to design a very, very complex interface at its terminal station called Scarborough City Center Station. And the whole purpose of that station was to build a new city. If you can imagine large mall subway being terminated there, and this whole idea of not only providing a seamless transportation interface for all the buses and everything that would come into it, but also building a new city around it. And so it became a very challenging process in its early days. This was in 2016, about sort of navigating the competing interests between Infrastructure Ontario, the provincial agency that was building a transit-oriented development, with the city's planning department, within the project delivery team, not about not having alignment on what the city should look like, but they also all had different ways of approaching the problem. And it was a very complex design problem, like a very complex values trade-off problem. And it persisted for a number of years until the kind of eve of delivery, when they were really under the gun and delivering the project. We helped support the agency by bringing a different approach to undertaking planning, which was instead of having to negotiate interest between the different parties and begin with a fixed set of requirements that they each had, to kind of turn it on its head a little bit and start with outcomes and interests, which is kind of a different way of approaching a planning problem. And I think it is helpful in getting people out of their own unique way of seeing a problem from their own agency's interests to being able to see it from a more holistic perspective. And so that was an interesting process of designing that, designing the stakeholder engagement process with the various agencies, and having some really, really difficult conversations and getting to a resolution in a very short period of time. And so that was really satisfying to see that happen. It wasn't the perfect solution, because each of the individual agencies, as you can imagine, working in the Bay Area, would have wanted to see a different solution. But we were able to get to a solution that the project delivery team kind of felt was in the best interest of the project, and actually addressed most of the interests satisfactorily enough, which is always a tough thing to do in these kinds of projects. Another interesting way to look at it is they all got enough of what they needed out of the project to have it help it move forward. So we were able to unstick a problem through a really unique process.
Congratulations. I know that's rare and takes some skill. How did you get the stakeholders to commit to a process like that, or trust in the process?
Oh, that was a very interesting part of it, because there did need to be commitment to the process. And what I find, particularly in these large infrastructure projects that you've probably seen in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California, the gestation period for these projects is so long. And the agency interests are pretty stable over time, but people come and go. And even within a very, very specific problem, what you see is that in any particular meeting or engagement, you might have different people around the table at a different point in time. And so that collective understanding of what the problem is, the collective understanding of an approach to solving it, is not always shared. And certainly people are kind of snacking on it on the edges. They're not part of an integrated process. So it was very, very important to us at the front end of the process, and also with our client, to communicate the need to have consistency in attendance, participation, and engagement throughout the process at a senior level. Because I think a lot of the organizations had been exhausted by how much time had gone on, and a lot of repetition and revisiting in the process. And so there was a willingness to do that. But we also made sure that at the beginning of the process, there was a commitment to stick with it, to have representation, and to see it through from beginning to end. And that was part of the success of the process, is that learning was happening as a group. The resolution of it was also shared at the end with everybody, so that everybody, even if they didn't agree with the outcome, I at least understood it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an inspiring story. I imagine sometimes you have to deliver news to executives, boards, or electeds who are making difficult decisions, news they don't want to hear. How do you approach that?
That's always a bit of a challenge. I always take an interest-based approach. I always try to put myself in somebody else's shoes to understand what their interests are. I heard somebody once say that, you know, we need to take the politics out of transit. And you'll probably chuckle when you hear that, because transit is actually all about policy and about politics. And the question for me is how to reflect the policy interests and political interests of transit in some of those discussions. So I always kind of take it from the perspective of, what would an elected official be concerned about? Well, they're concerned about their constituents and the interests of their constituents. And what is a board that has oversight interested in? They're interested in ensuring that management is doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. I always kind of look at it from the perspective of, what is the interest of the person that I'm in dialogue with? And I think that helps to put yourself in their shoes, and they often appreciate it.
I'm guessing you weren't always this successful and wise on every project. So could you share a learning moment at Access Planning, maybe where something didn't go how you thought it would, but you ended up with some important takeaway or learning for the future?
Yeah, I mean, there always is. I actually learn and do better from failing constantly. I think we all do. That is the human experience. I think one of the challenges in transit generally is we often see governance problems related to how decision-making happens, how interests are arbitrated, and ultimately about culture and people and politics. And that's something that I learn and learn again on every single project. In most cities, there's a lot of technological politics about what transit mode is best, whether it's a bus, an LRT, a subway, or so on. In the context of every region, it's a little bit different. But these are often almost theological debates. Like, there are belief systems around these. And underlying them are always some core values. For me, what this actually reflected was not what the right technological solution was, because in each case, there was probably, like, in a technical sense, the most efficient solution was quite obvious. But underlying kind of a value to get something better were some political values and municipal values that were actually driving decision making. And I would say, like, earlier in my career, I was a little bit more oblivious. And so a big learning moment for me was that actually you have to bring policy and politics and local preference into decision making, because at the end of the day, it actually drives the decisions. So my preference is for that to be more explicit in decision making, so that decision makers can have a debate about it rather than to kind of downplay it. It drives decision-making. And so you need to recognize it, provide a little bit of structure to the dialogue about what the political trade-offs are between various options if we're going to make a good decision. You know, Ratna, that we recently worked on, and that's how we met, is doing some work for the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Governance for the Bay Area and trying to convene a really broad group of stakeholders, the MTC operators, the NGOs and stakeholder interests in the region, to try and think about how could the region be governed differently from a decision-making perspective, how to bring regional values into decision-making for what today are very local decisions. And that was one where, again, there are probably some obvious answers to what the end state should be or what a solution might look like, but understanding the kind of the politics and the history and the culture that is driving decision-making is really, really important to kind of convening that conversation. And regions are both very, very similar and very, very different in the way that they run. You know, everybody says San Francisco is very special. Well, it actually, you know, newsflash, it's not, but it is. It kind of is special in its own need because it has its own governing context. It's got its own culture and history. And you can't just take solutions from elsewhere and apply them to the Bay Area. But what you can do is take a lot of lessons learned and then and then consider how to adapt them to the local context. And again, that's one project that I worked on recently where it wasn't necessarily anything that was done wrong or anything, but just a validation that that kind of, you know, thinking about local context and culture and history is really important to getting to a better decision on a transit project.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think the politics and policy are always present in actually driving the process, but typical planning processes don't have methodologies for that. And this is something I've really admired about your firm and the way you've been able to marry decision-making and what we know to be true about stakeholder processes and politics into the planning process. Because even if regions are different, I think there are archetypal processes at work.
Yeah.
Between people's vision and what they imagine and reality.
Well, what's your experience of that in the Bay Area?
I think what you see in the Bay Area and probably other regions that have a multitude of governing bodies and a lot of different consultants and staff cultures is a proliferation of approaches to things that kind of means we never learn how to solve the same problem well, because we're doing it differently every time. People are using different nomenclature. We're running processes. Some look more like a planning process. Some look more like an engineering process. Some look like a political process. But actually, in general, groups and organizations have some, I think, more universal processes that could be used. So I have a bias, and I think you do too, around good process. And so what I experienced in the Bay Area is like a real opportunity to have more unification around best practices around process for whether it's a governing board or a multi-agency process or even a singular team, because we're talking about the same topics. We're talking about transit and transportation. It shouldn't feel like a new process every single time.
Getting that codification of like figuring out a good practice, and then when you see it, having it be repeatable and documented and actually know that you can actually, you know, learn from it, that process learning over time is really, really important. The other thing that I noticed as a theme for me is in some of the learning and across projects that we've been working on now across Canada and the US is that some of the agencies and some of the regions that are best positioned to like deal with some of these really tough transit decisions and actually get really, really good outcomes are the ones that are actually have processes in place to do things more consistently, more integrated, and more from a shared interest perspective across a wider geography, usually the region. And the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area is very similar to the Bay Area, both about 8 million people. And Greater Toronto area has a dozen transit agencies. Bay Area has about 24 in the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, particularly on the mega projects. But on the transit services, the bus transit services and local transit services in particular, there is still a high level of fragmentation and very little in the way of consistency and method and philosophy around how to do it, which is a challenge on the ground for communities and transit users because they experience that fragmentation that's there at the political and agency level. And so there's a lot to be learned from other agencies that are kind of and regions that are moving in a more positive direction in terms of decision making, in terms of process. And one example I could give on that is Montreal, where they regionally have the same challenge as the Bay Area and Toronto in terms of fragmented agency governance region wide. But the province took some steps to create a regional network manager, similar to what's being talked about in Bay Area, with very, very strong authorities in certain areas that were important to integration. Just to give you a couple of examples in the legislation that created that authority while keeping the local agency still intact, within a 2-year period, the Montreal region was able to deliver fair integration at a regional level. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why they did that. But the most important thing is it was decided that it was a regional interest to give a singular authority to one entity to be able to deliver it. And they were able to do that in 2 years. They also did the same thing with a value capture tax for transit funding. We're able to deliver it within a year and a half with a strong mandate. There's some other parts of it that are quite weak around network planning, but the whole idea is that there are ways to get some of these successes in place through regional interest thinking.
Oh, there's lots to follow up on there.
Yeah.
I want to shift to your work around cities.
Yeah.
So you advise organizations so that they can improve cities. If you were building a city from the ground up, which folks are thinking about in various places, what sorts of things would you prioritize in order to future-proof your city? What would you want to get perfectly right from the start?
Oh, wow. That's a very big question. When I went to grad school, SimCity was a really big thing. And I used to like play around with my cities and I would let my 486 computer run overnight so it could simulate it. And I was always fascinated about this idea of like building a city from the ground up. So I would love to be able to try that one day. I'll answer it in two parts. I'm a really strong believer in governance as a really important shaper of how and decision-making and a really important shaper of cities. For people that work in city planning, you probably know this, like when you put a road down, when you set the fundamental structure of a city, it's very, very challenging. It takes a really, really long time to undo that. If you get it wrong the first time, it's really, really tough. And we see this in cities around the world, like their grid structures that exist in Vancouver or San Francisco are probably not going to change that much. It's the bones of the city. So I think getting that right is the first thing is like, how do we plan together? How do we decide together is really, really important. How do you engage communities from the ground up in deciding what's important? The other thing is, I think, is I would start with inverting the triangle of what we typically are working on in North American cities right now is we're trying to fix the problem with really big projects, rail projects, which are structure forming. But it actually, cities are actually built from the ground up with the finer details. So instead of starting with the biggest projects first, it's starting with the smallest details first and then building your city up from that. Having a foot-first strategy, like, you know, for sustainable cities, what we need most is prioritizing walking and cycling and those people-powered modes first, supporting those with really high-quality public transportation, having a really sensible road network to be able to provide the structure and bones of the city for circulation, which is essential for goods movement and so on, and then having like a really good superstructure of, you know, the major regional infrastructure that could be rail infrastructure, transit infrastructure, and so on. People often look at European cities and say, well, you know, the most resilient, the capable of achieving higher transit mode share, more walkability, and it's based on getting that core right in most European cities. The transit extension of it is there in the inner ring and then sort of the outer ring of those cities. So getting that formula right is really important from the get-go. I want to touch on the COVID era and what's made some cities more resilient to others. So Vancouver and Portland are identical size regions, 3 million people each. They both have rail networks that are comparable sizes. And I think Portland's is even a bit longer in length. Vancouver's is more intense because it has a higher frequency of service. Both same size, both have robust transit networks. Portland might even have more rail network. TransLink's COVID ridership during those COVID 2 years was as high as Portland's pre-COVID ridership. And this sort of speaks to a lot of what it takes to be a resilient city. So it turns out that Metro Vancouver is about 2.5 times as dense as Portland. There's been a lot of debates about whether it's about the level of transit service and so on that's resulted in agencies bouncing back from COVID. And right now in the suburbs, it's about 110%. And I attribute this to having a resilient system. It's able to bounce back because it has all of the fundamentals in place to actually make it resilient. And the first point of resilience is actually having a very strong and resilient urban form that's able to bounce back quicker. It also had a good governing framework. And the good governing framework meant that it could rationalize transit service and get the right distribution of transit service across the region during COVID. So it actually did some interesting things, like my neighborhood, which is inner city. We had our frequency dropped to maintain a policy headway in suburban areas. Now, I didn't notice that my headway dropped because it dropped from 8 minutes to 10 minutes, which is not really noticeable. But in Surrey, in the suburban area, going from a half-hour service to a one-hour service could easily get you into the transit death spiral. The transit death spiral being worsening service means that fewer people ride it and so on. So they were able to look at the region from an integrated perspective and make rational decisions so that it put itself on a good footing for recovery. And then it had all the natural advantages of good land use. So I think recreating a city that has those strong attributes of good governance and good bones to make it a resilient city is really, really important.
Thank you for that. I love how you tied all those pieces together. What makes you optimistic about the future of cities in Canada?
Canada is a high growth country still, and Canadian urban centers are high growth. And I think one of the biggest challenges that face cities in kind of adapting to the future is not even actually having the benefit of growth to grow in better ways. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the city of Calgary, in the mid-2000s, a population of 100,000 grew very, very rapidly over the next 10 to 12 years. Well, it was a really phenomenal growth over that period. It was kind of distributed mostly in suburban areas throughout a large urban region. So it became very, very difficult to service that from a transit perspective. Through the mid-2010s, the city council was really focusing on transit-oriented development, bring development together into more transit-oriented communities, higher density, mixed use, all services close together to kind of boost transit ridership and create a more sustainable city. Unfortunately, Calgary's high growth period had actually disappeared. So it was much, much harder to do that during that period. If there's no development, there's no transit-oriented development. You have to actually decamp people from suburban housing and put them into, you know, it's not a practical thing to be done. We're now moving into a higher growth period again in that region. So there's a really great opportunity in Calgary to take modern values around planning, around governance, around sustainability, and really to make some tough decisions at a city scale to focusing almost all of that development in areas where it's building, you know, this major infrastructure. That takes political courage and that takes foresight. But there's an opportunity now to be able to do that in that region. And I would say the same thing in Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, where it's one of the highest growth regions in North America, very strong tech sector. It's almost in the same situation where San Francisco, the Bay Area, was in the mid-2000s in terms of being a real magnet for talent, for investment, and so on. It's probably only resolvable in its higher density forms. There's a sort of confluence of global and national and regional factors that I think it can drive a lot of integration between positive transportation and city building agenda and positive agendas around climate, around housing. And I would say the Bay Area is probably maybe another inflection point of opportunity where there is maybe significant risk that, you know, cost of living, infrastructure deficit, fractured regional planning, were all threatening to diminish the Bay Area's competitive advantage. I think that threat is larger today than it ever was. And so what's the opportunity? I think in the Bay Area, you have a lot of these agendas that are colliding again around housing, around climate, and an opportunity around, you know, you see the boom in artificial intelligence maybe providing like a new backbone for kind of economic interest and a bit of a boost for the Bay Area. Whether it can capitalize on those opportunities is going to be interesting to see in the next decade or so.
Yeah, absolutely. An interesting comparison.
Yeah. And one other project that we worked on recently was for the rehabilitation of Michigan Central Station in Detroit. We actually helped with the public art strategy for that building. And really interesting that Ford owns that Michigan Central Station, the Union Station in Detroit. And, you know, the idea is to create a future forward mobility campus, technology campus for Ford in that region. And it was just really interesting working in the Detroit industry to see in the Detroit area to see how something that seems like this unstoppable economic force and is the backbone of growth and development and wealth in a region disappears so quickly. And I think that's where, you know, a region like the Bay Area could potentially be, where technology, which was at the forefront of growth, if it fosters complacency, can take you one place. If it fosters renewal and innovation and ongoing renewal and innovation, can take you in another place.
Yeah, the Michigan area definitely is a scenario for the Bay Area, maybe other regions to consider. So in addition to your work at Access Planning, you are a board of director for the largest ferry operator in North America, the British Columbia Ferry Services, BC Ferry. So tell us about some of the challenges the BC Ferries is facing.
British Columbia Ferries, BC Ferries, is part of the coastal identity of the province of British Columbia, is really critical to the economic and social well-being of our entire province. About 75% of British Columbia's population lives in a coastal community or coastal adjacent community out of a province of about 5 million people. So we're talking about 4 million people are interacting with the coast. And there's a lot of islands, a lot of population that needs to be connected economically, socially, and culturally across the province. So it's a very, very critical services. And I'm very passionate about my work there because I really believe in this province and I love living here. And I have experienced it over the past 35 years of living here. And it's both something, and I'll say this as a board member, it's something that you love and hate at the same time. Because when you're on a BC ferry, there is nothing more magnificent in the world than experiencing this place and this province and the water. It's just from an experience perspective is really special. On the other hand, it's a very, very challenging transportation service to operate. One of the challenges that BC Ferries has had is actually rooted in the change to its governing model about 20 years ago, where the province changed the ferry services model to have the agency managed at arm's length from government. There was lots of historical reasons for doing that. It actually led to some interesting things happening in its early years around vessel renewal and infrastructure renewal. But the governing model actually was created around ensuring that the services were delivered safely, efficiently, and reliably in its current state. It didn't really anticipate a model for it to grow with the province over time. So 20 years later, we're in a much different context today than operating the same vessels day in and day out and just replacing them. The mobility is changing. BC Ferries is primarily geared towards moving vehicles from the Vancouver Lower Mainland to Vancouver Island and between coastal communities. And so that's one challenge. The other challenge has been the challenge of compound growth. We've been growing at, you know, 1.5 to 2% annual population growth over the past 20 years. And the system is just much more significant in terms of the needs for economic connectivity and so on. And also our values are changing. You know, we have two things that are driving decision-making around ferries in a very significant way. One is reconciliation with Indigenous peoples in the province. The province of British Columbia is still primarily on unceded territory. And the other is around the climate agenda. And, you know, ferries consume a lot of fuel. So the challenge that we have at BC Ferries is we haven't typically had a framework for reimagining what the future of ferries looks like. And that takes a lot of coordination with government that is a primary funder to the operations. It funds about one third of the operations today. The ferry users fund the other two third. So one of the interesting things we did to reboot our vision of the future was actually create a collaborative interest-based roundtable of all the governing interests of the ferry authority to imagine what the future might look like and to also come up with a plan for how to address all of these challenges that we face around capacity, around reliability, around growth, around climate and reconciliation. We're in the middle of that process right now. Should we be buying these car-oriented vessels or should we be shifting towards more passenger orientation? You know, how do we deal with modal interface with these cities? How do people get there? Is it by car? Is it by bus? Is it by bike? Is it, you know, all of these challenges are ones that we need to address. It's proving to be like a very, very rewarding experience and one that I think and hope will lead to a better, more resilient future for BC Ferries.
Oh, they're so lucky to have you
on
the board of directors. Where would they be? Okay, last couple of things I want to ask you about. On top of everything else we've discussed, you're an adjunct professor at UBC School of Community and Regional Planning in its master's program. So if students can just take one thing away from your teaching, from your experience, one thing you'd want to pass on to the next generation of students, those who are listening as well, what would it be?
The advice that to give to planners for me is to plan slow. That really important process of convening interests at the front end of projects, of being very deliberate about what your intentions are. Those are, in planning parlance, what we would call objectives. And then also being able to reconcile that with the realities of culture, people, politics, which actually drives decision-making, is really, really important to do in a very intentional way, in a very methodical way, and then in a discursive and dialogue-based way with interests around the table. It's harder in practice because I think we have a sense of what the ideal solution is, and we tend to be very solution-oriented and technically oriented. And there are reasons behind all of this. And I think a lot of it relates to how projects are conceived and delivered and planned. And as much as we know we need to do that work at the front end of projects, we aren't practiced enough in doing it. And it's not given enough space in our planning processes. And it's really, really important. I don't know if you've seen this book, Get Big Things Done by Bent Fluvia, doing a lot of thinking around mega projects. And I think that one of his major theses is around planning slow so you can deliver fast. So it's the greatest mega project deliverers, the Frank Gehrys of the world, are really deliberate and intentional at the front end so that they make fewer mistakes, which tend to be the more expensive and time-consuming mistakes on the back end of the project when you're actually spending the billions of dollars. So bringing that kind of thinking and appreciation and culture into planning is really, really important so that we can save time, money, and outcome on the back end of a lot of these projects.
That really resonates for me. Okay, the last two questions are questions we've been asking all of our guests. So I'm sure the work you do can be stressful or hectic. Where do you find order in chaos?
Planning is both ordered and chaotic at the same time, at the best of times. Part of a good creative and iterative planning process, both order and chaos. And I do find I struggle with this duality in my profession. I'm both very, very structured, and I demand structure in my own work and with my colleagues and the people that I work with, and try to facilitate that with our clients. That iterative part of planning is really, really important, and being able to introduce, I wouldn't call it chaos, but creativity and iteration and lateral thinking and process is really, really important. So I would say those things is just so appreciate those dualities. They're both valid in good planning work, but they have to be there in the right balance, and then learn from others and surround yourself with people who are good compliments to you, that are good compliments from an energy perspective, a temperament perspective, and a work process perspective.
Oh, that's good advice. So one last question before I let you go. Is there any major infrastructure project anywhere in the world that is on your bucket list to go and see one day?
Well, I'll tell you one that has been on my bucket list and is recently completed. And I've been able to see it at different points in its evolution. And I just in February it was on my bucket list to see it in operation, which is the Crossrail project in London. And I have had the great benefit of working with the UK Department of International Trade and helping them to facilitate study tours of Canadian public infrastructure developers and deliverers to the UK to learn from project delivery there, and have been able to see a Crossrail project kind of evolve through its life cycle. A colleague of mine, Joshua Anglian, just did a posting on lessons learned from Crossrail. If you're interested in mega project delivery, take a look at that. It's really great to see that project deliver an amazing public service. It's an amazing piece of transformative infrastructure for London, and I think it's going to pay dividends for decades to come. I really do believe that.
Add it to your bucket list, folks. Great recommendation. Tamin, thank you for joining the show and sharing so much of your experience and insight with us today. It was awesome.
Thank you. And it was great to talk to you. And we have a couple of things to pick up on in the near future. So let's have a chat.
I would love that. Take care. Our guest today, once again, was Tamin Rudd. Thanks so much for joining us, Tamin, and telling us about your work at Access Planning.
It's been a real pleasure. And thank you all once again for listening to our show. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to leave a review so more people can find us. Until next time, I'm Ratna Amin, and this has been Infrastructure Momentum Makers, presented by Ansarada.